You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 10th of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24. Coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll be getting tips on what to see on Broadway and in the West End with Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune.
We'll also get a cultural look ahead for the coming days. Today we have a special focus on Amsterdam.
If you prefer non-fiction, then Wednesday sees the start of the International Documentary Film Festival Amsterdam, or ITFA. It's a special edition this year as organizers are celebrating the 25th anniversary of the event.
And we'll be joined in the studio by Bill Brewster, DJ and author of Last Night, A DJ Saved My Life, to get some musical recommendations.
I wrote a song for America, they told me it was clever. Jessica's gone on vacation on the dark side of town forever. Who knew?
And we'll get some tips on new fashion and photography titles in our visit to Claire de Rouen Books here in London.
I guess I'm interested in the way photography started out, claiming to be able to represent the truth in a way that the other arts couldn't. But these books both kind of use photography to think about mystery or what's mysterious.
So as ever, lots to look forward to on this week's review right here on Monocle 24.
And a very warm welcome to Studio One here at Midori House, joined by Gillian DeBias. And if you can hear some rustling in the background, that is the IHT's theatre critic, Matt Wolfe, who is creeping into the studio to join us. Gillian, we wanted to talk about a film to start off with that we have both seen. And I know that Matt has seen it. So when he sat down and settled, we'll bring him as well. This is Beasts of the Southern Wild.
It's one of those films that kind of goes under the radar and there's a quiet word of mouth, and I'd been meaning to see it and meaning to see it, and a bit late really because it was winner at Sundance, it was winner at Cannes, so I came onto it quite late, and then I thought this would be great if we both saw it and we could discuss it. But a gem, disturbing, troubling, not an easy film, but one of those films that you think about after you've left the cinema, you think about more and more and more, not just the hours after, but days after. What did you think, Matt?
Matt, you're handsomely ensconced in your seat. Could you briefly recap the plot for us? Because it's quite apocalyptic.
It is. It's basically a father-daughter drama set in the kind of nether regions below or beneath, whatever word you would use, the Levee in New Orleans, Louisiana, at a time of great crisis, both in the natural world and also in the familial world of this little unit. There's no mother. These are people really scrambling to get by. But what's interesting is it's a sort of remarkable tribute to community. The family have the option in the film to be kind of restored, as it were, brought into the world to find care, to find sustenance, and they retreat from it. They want, at the end of the day, whatever their problems are, and their problems are manifold, they want to be together. It's also established this remarkable young actress, whose first name is Kwevice, as a front runner for the Oscar for Best Actress, and she's, you know, about 2'3".
Auditioned
and 6 years old.
Yeah. Auditioned at five, in the film at six, now 8 years old. Let's have a quick listen to the film.
Depends on everything fitting together just right. If one piece busts, even the smallest piece, the entire universe will get busted.
This here is an aurochs, a fierce creature.
The storm's coming! The storm's coming!
Y'all better learn how to survive.
I'm your daddy. It's just my job to take care of you.
Okay?
And that was a clip of Beasts of the Southern
Wild.
I can never remember the film, and I've seen it. I was absolutely astonished by my reaction to the film because I had been given the impression that it was an uplifting film. But it, as you say, Matt, it's a father-daughter tale in the face of adversity and the fact that they build their own society in a totally chaotic environment. And her survival is entirely dependent on the fact that she absolutely identifies with the natural world around her. And this is a theme that runs key throughout the film would also run key throughout the film is her idea that her father, who is drunk, psychologically imbalanced and also on the point of death, is on paper an absolutely terrible father, yet he inspires fierce loyalty in her.
And love.
And I was divided by feeling admiration for this little family unit that screamed in the face of the storm. And then the other side of me, which perhaps I'm getting a bit old and, you know, old in my boots, was going, take the girl into care, sort her out, she's got a future, she's great, let this man decay and die.
There have been a lot of people who've resisted the film because they think, what is she so upset about? The idea of entering the world, letting people take over her life. But I think it's a tribute, very American tribute to individualism, resilience in the face of all possible adversity. And it's got a kind of magical realist quality to it as well. It's almost as if Gabriel Garcia Marquez had written novels set in Louisiana, this is what they might be like on screen. Also, the guy who plays the father, who's wonderful, I gather in real life was a baker.
Yeah. He sold them their donuts when they were wrecking locations.
I'd buy donuts from him and anything else.
I wouldn't if he was anything like the father, I must confess. You talk about the element of magical realism, and it is a theme that is sown through the film. One scene that I found particularly impressive was the preparations just before the storm, when they the father, in a drunken, raging way, tries to prepare his little girl for what we know is going to be the great flood, and he puts a pair of armbands on her and puts her in a little trunk and says, that's your boat, and when it gets so bad you punch your way through the roof, and the whole place shakes, and it's astonishing to watch on screen. Then, slightly disappointingly, there's this this magical, mythical figure that we've just heard a clip of in the film, of this sort of large pig, basically, which is the emblem of doom, that every time the pig turns up you know something terrible is about to happen. And I found that quite disappointing. What did you think, Gillian?
Well, that was the one side that I think let the film down a bit. But still, there's so many other layers to it that I thought were fascinating. To me, I loved the whole theme of water, and I found it like a Noah's Ark. I thought here was the end of the world. And they had their little, you know, handmade from oil tins kind of raft. And it was a bit of, it was the hope, but it was the Noah's Ark, whether it was the, you know, the crazy, mad little society they put on their boat. But to me, it was hope.
And also this little girl, you say the emblem of doom, quite rightly, but what's astonishing, and I don't want to give away the very end too much, but there's certainly the suggestion that she, in all of her tiny little pugnaciousness, can stare down anything that comes her way, and that is the last lingering shot.
One gets that impression. What I also found quite charming was the way that the film managed to realise a child's vision of a lost mother. That obviously her mother has died or has gone away in some way. We're not told that. But the child obviously has this deep yearning to be with her mother again. And there's a lovely symbol of a light far, far away on the sea. We get almost flooded ourselves with just water, water, water everywhere. And yet at the end of this horizon, which is incredibly wet, there's this tiny light, which she associates with her mother. And I thought that was a delightful
way of how
a child sees hope, life, love, or whatever it is. It was an absolutely charming piece.
And also there were some interesting things, I mean, that found real-life parallels with recent Superstorm Sandy, in that there were many communities, we were told, where even though people were told to evacuate, they didn't, because to them, home and hearth are paramount. Whatever nature throws in your way.
Absolutely.
And I think there's something of that going on in this movie.
I thought the power of home was absolutely extraordinary. And when at one point in the film, when they're offered sanctuary in this white, pristine hospital, they escape, you know, because home is where the heart
home is.
Is
chaos. Well, you mentioned a moment ago, Matt, Superstorm Sandy and the effects that it had on the people of New York. We will stay on that theme because we have brought you in ostensibly to talk about theatre today.
Yes,
indeed.
We
just sidetracked slightly with the film review. Mm-hmm. You were trying to get to Broadway, but Broadway's currently mopping up after Sandy.
Yes.
And even when the lights came back on, the audiences couldn't get there. You were supposed to be one of those audiences.
You
tried to get to Broadway, you didn't. What happened?
Well, I had three different flights that were booked on three successive days, and it just became a nonsense after a while. One cancellation followed another, and by the time I could have got there, I would have had to turn around and come back. I mean, actually, Broadway recovered pretty quickly. There are 40 Broadway theaters, and they're all above the demarcation line, as was during Superstorm Sandy, below which there was no power, no electricity. So much of off-Broadway was dark for the better part of a week. week, and that represents incalculable loss. Broadway did suffer. They grosses were down about 30%. That took a hit of about $8.5 million, which is not nothing. But most of the shows are back up and running by Wednesday.
What do you think the long-term effects will be, though, on Broadway? Because the immediate problem faced by Broadway is that their lights were on, but many of the audiences were still stuck.
The thing about Broadway that people perhaps don't realize is that the profit margins for any show, I mean, it's true in London as well, are very, very slim. I mean, it operates absolutely on the most sort of finest of tight ropes. And, you know, if you're a show that's what they call a nervous hit, where you have to make a profit every week to keep going, you can't afford this. And, you know, yes, you're back up and running, but if your audience can't get to you, because the other thing was that the subways were down for a while, the commuter trains in and out of Manhattan were down, you know, it's that thing about what if you give a party and nobody comes.
And were people in the mood to go to theatre those weeks, especially with the election coming up?
Yes, exactly. It was very, very bad timing. Interestingly, there was one Broadway show, the revival of David Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross starring Al Pacino, which took advantage of Superstorm Sandy to delay their opening night almost a month. Now, so it's now going to open on the 8th of December, not the 11th of November. And what they were claiming was, oh, Superstorm Sandy threw a spanner in the works. What Broadway insiders are actually saying is that Superstorm Sandy had nothing to do with it. It's that Al Pacino needs another month to get the role under his skin.
Right.
So what were you going to see? What are going to be the big productions unfolding this fall?
Well, I wanted to see, and I won't see it now because it's finishing in 2 weeks, I wanted to see the wonderful British actor Douglas Hodge in Cyrano de Bergerac, his first show on Broadway since he won the Tony Award a few years ago for La Cage aux Folles. I wanted to see Jake Gyllenhaal's American theater debut in a British play by Nick Payne. But most of the other shows I was going to see, including Glengarry, will be running when I'm next there over Christmas. And, you know, it's not as if there was nothing to see in London, like many productions of Uncle Vanya.
So you stayed in London, where there is a Chekhov deluge hitting the city.
Yes, it's Superstorm Chekhov. And, you know, it's always raining Anton in London. There's another production coming up in a few weeks with Matthew Kelly of The Seagull at a little very enterprising fringe theatre called the Southwark Playhouse. What was interesting this past week was that there were two Uncle Vanyas basically back to back. One was an absolutely bog standard English language production in a version by Christopher Hampton at the Vaudeville Theatre, a commercial run with Ken Stott and Anna Friel. And then opening 3 or 4 days later was a Russian language production, which actually finishes today at the Noel Coward Theater, in Russian, from the Vakhtangov Theater Company. They could not have been more different. And it
no
was really interesting.
No samovars, I hear.
No samovars, no birch trees, no sort of quiet sort of library acting, very baleful and doleful. The
but
Russian production
was
Chekhov.
Big. Really? What does it feel like to, well, what's it like to watch Chekhov in Russian?
Well, this Russian production is not like every other Russian production, okay. Chekhov. I mean, I have seen some Russian productions which follow the Stanislavskian line of, you know, let's be very soulful and kind of intense. This one was very bold, very aggressive, very absurdist. And it was just so interesting because the director of it, the Russian one, threw out the rule book. He was just like, this is how it's been done for 100 years. Forget it. We're forging our own way. Whereas Lindsay Posner, who directed the English language production with Ken Stott, does it absolutely pro forma. And it's a bit, I have to say, a bit banal. There was a controversy that erupted apropos of the Ken Stott one on opening night. Now, I wasn't there that night. I went to the final preview. But the controversy is interesting because the great and venerable theater director Sir Peter Hall was reported at the very end of the play in a beautiful final scene between Vanya and his niece Sonia.
Sonia's monologue, which is astonishing.
Beautiful. It's one of the great moments in world literature and drama. Sir Peter was reported to have had a sort of a spontaneous outburst saying, stop, stop, this is terrible. I would have been better off watching television, something to that effect. And you thought, this is a bit strange. The man who founded the Royal Shakespeare Company kind of shouting out at actors on a stage. He then issued a beautifully, I thought, phrased apology via his publicist a couple days later, saying, you know, I'm an old man, which he is, he's in his 80s. I had drifted off. I woke up, I was disorientated, and this is what happened. And, you know, I absolutely believe that because I've seen lots of fellow critics and audience goers who are a lot younger than Sir Peter have exactly this happen to them. So I forgive Sir Peter totally. The other thing is that Sir Peter directed himself a production of Uncle Vanya
about 4 years ago, 2008, which was brilliant.
It was wonderful. So, you know, there we are.
The main play, as you said, there was the commercial side of it. British television viewers will be no stranger to the likes of Anna Friel. Actually, an international audience. And she is Yelena, isn't she?
Yes, she is.
Is she any good? Because Yelena has to be idle and sexy at the same time.
She has to be idle and sexy, but she can't just be listless and indolent. There has to be an energy to her idleness. And I actually thought she was very good. I thought she and Ken Stott were the best ones in it. I mean, Yelena's a tricky part because it's easy for the audience to turn against her because she is, in erotic terms, she's the pivot of the play. And she kind of upends this household, which is already on the point of a certain amount of hysteria. And she just sort of catapults it over the edge. But she does a very, very good job. She's unusually sympathetic in the part, and it's a part that doesn't have to be. Ken Stott, though, who plays the title role, he plays Vanya, is just brilliant. I mean, why can't he be in a play once a year? He's such a wonderful actor. He's got such fury and again, energy. You don't want torpid, languid Chekhov. That's the mimetic fallacy. You want it to be emboldened. And he was just great. I would have loved to have seen him in the Russian language production, because I think his energy would have suited that production very well.
For those
Chekhov is just so Russian at its core. Can Brits play Chekhov well? And also, what are the elements that translate well into the 21st century? Why is it so eternally popular?
Well, the reason Chekhov resonates, I think, for most of us, certainly for me, is he's the great theatrical poet of loss. Nobody writes about loss and frustration and dislocation better than he. And as far as translating to the British, I think it was Cyrian McKellen, who's done a lot of Chekhov a few years ago, who said that he's almost been domesticated as a British playwright. And I think that's true. I don't know this statistically, but I would bet that he's the most frequently performed playwright in this country after Shakespeare.
There is something about the sort of provincial element of Chekhov, which the Brits really, really do channel into. And there's another play which I think you wanted to mention, which has been premiering this week, which again has the great country house on the point of decline, but in a completely different situation. This is Alan Bennett's latest play. Alan Bennett now, 78, 79 years old?
78,
Carrying the rather unlucky, you know, the uneasy lies ahead that wears the name of National Treasure, because he hates being a national treasure. So he says he's put out this new play called People to try and just stick a knife through the ribs of those who think he is the tea and buns writer of the United Kingdom.
Well, it's funny, as you absolutely rightly say, that he's often characterised as a national treasure, and here he's written a play about the National Trust. and the thing about Alan Bennett that is often misunderstood is that maybe it's because he does all these book at bedtimes and he's got this rather wonderful voice and he's never lost his northern accent, and so he sounds totally delightful. But there's a lot of fire in the belly with Alan Bennett. I mean, he's often fueled by anger during the heyday of Mrs. Thatcher. A lot of it was directed against her. And if there's an issue that he feels passionately about, you know it. And one of the things that he doesn't like is the way in which the National Trust commodifies lives, that it turns, you know, the idiosyncratic experience into something that we can package for ready consumption. I think, though, the problem with this play, which is minor Bennett, I'm sorry to say, because nobody loves him more than I do, is that it's a series of sort of positions on topics, not quite finding a play.
What's the play about?
It's about a rather threadbare, aging woman called Dorothy Stackpole, played by Frances de La Tour, who's a bit of a Bennett regular. And she and her companion, and we later find out who the companion is, but I won't possibly give it away, played by Linda Bassett, are inhabiting this kind of old pile, which is literally falling apart around them, and they are falling apart with it. And in order for the house to have a kind of resurgence, they decide to rent it out, I have to say, to me, completely improbably, to the filming of a porn movie. So much
called
of the
brilliantly Reach for the Thigh.
Much of the second act is taken up with kind of rather cheap carry-on style gags about what you would do if you were sort of an aging, perhaps prim and proper, although perhaps less prim and proper than at first thought, a woman or women with a porn movie happening around you. And it turns out that the director of the porn movie, again, completely improbably, is somebody with whom the Frances de La Tour character had a previous liaison. So not sure about that. But it's worth it for this wonderful transformation of the set, a wonderful set by the venerable Bob Crowley, at the very end where this wreck of a place is magically restored in front of our eyes. And it is a gorgeous moment.
One of the things I wanted to touch on, which something you wrote about recently, is site-specific theatre that it seems to be quite a lot of in London. Do you think it works? Do you find it exciting?
Yeah, I kept thinking with this play, it would have been fun to do it in an old wreck of a house, but then I don't think you'd be able to get 800 people cramming into some pile in Wiltshire. I do find site-specific theatre very exciting, and I think there's going to be more of it, not less, because I think what theatre makers are looking for is a way to re-embolden the experience.
So what are we now looking ahead to the next few days
weeks? The next few weeks, we're looking ahead at something which has been in short supply this year, which are musicals. We've got a lot of musicals coming up, new and revivals. Who knows what they'll be like, but we've got The Bodyguard. Many will remember the Whitney Houston movie. We've got the Spice Girls musical, Viva Forever.
What?
opening December 11th. We've got a revival of one of my favorite musicals, Merrily We Roll Along by Sondheim. And then in the new year, we've got The Book of Mormon.
So, which is what?
The Book of Mormon is this multi-award-winning Broadway show that during the wrath of Superstorm Sandy was still selling out and playing to 103%. People would literally cross waves and floodwaters to get to The Book of Mormon. We'll see whether they do
in London.
And
you've seen it?
Yeah.
Worth it?
Yes, it's a lot smuttier than People.
Brilliant. Sign me up.
Thank you, as ever, for joining us here on The Review. After the short break, we're beginning our cultural roundup with Nelly Gacheva. Stay tuned.
If you like Subways, not Subway sandwiches, if you want to know what makes a metropolis thrive or take a dive, and if you prefer the concrete jungle to the muddy field, then you need The Urbanist. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we explore the urban landscape by tram, subway and taxi to meet the people out to make urban life even better. In this episode of The Urbanist, we're going to get a bit self-reflective and turn our sights on the media, whether the voice of a megacity, the newsagent with the best Rolodex, or how one bookseller has become Tokyo's best refuge.
To describe Tsutaya as a bookstore would be doing it a disservice. Think of the best magazine kiosk you've ever seen, combined with the coziest bookshop. Throw in a lounge bar, a comprehensively stocked DVD shop and music store, and you're getting close.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're back with The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias.
And time now to satisfy the entertainment needs of those at a loose end this weekend and perhaps feeling the need to hop on a plane. Looking for inspiration of where to go and what to see? Well, here now is Monocle's associate editor, Nelly Gacheva, in our Toronto bureau to talk us through some highlights.
This weekend, Gallery Nef in Ankara welcomes a solo exhibit by local contemporary painter Burcu Persin. Named Hidden and Secretive, the show presents Persin's latest oil paintings of abandoned urban spaces. The line of canvas is a must-see, especially if you're into colossal, close-to-real-life size art. Hidden and Secretive is on until the 1st of December. This weekend in Montreal, the Montreal-Brooklyn Contemporary Art Event showcases a series of exhibitions by artists from the two North American artistic communities. On Saturday, we recommend Reconstruction by visual artist Ott Moreau, a video montage providing a refreshing view of New York cityscape. Montreal-Brooklyn Contemporary Art is in Montreal until the 17th of November, and then in Brooklyn in January. Staying in Canada, in Toronto this weekend, the Rio Asian Film Festival celebrates its 16th edition with an impressive selection of cinematic masterpieces, including Korean blockbuster Architecture 101 and action drama Cold Steel. This year's edition seeks to provide awareness of Canada's cultural diversity with an introspective on the cultural and social influences of Asian heritage through film. For more, go to realasian.com. A stone's throw from Monaco's London headquarters on Dorsey Street is the picture-perfect Atlas Gallery. This weekend, the intimate space hosts the work of German photography pioneer Floris Noises. the work draws heavily on the medium of photogram, a camera-less technique that places objects in front of light-sensitive paper to create bold and colorful silhouettes. The exhibit includes a selection of images from nudes to ancient Greek statues, and it is on until the 12th of January. And for your weekend soundtrack, we recommend Brooklyn's Afrobeat act, Antibalas. The 10-member band is in France this weekend and then in London on Wednesday. For more details, go to antibalas.com. This is their track, Dirty Money. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gocheva.
Dirty, not dirty money, oh. Dirty money, not the fruit. Dirty, not dirty money, oh. Dirty money, not the fruit. Oh, yeah. A man go drowning in the river. He call his brother, save me now. His brother showed up. He toss him coin with not the fruit.
Antibalas there, ending that look ahead from Monocle's Nelly Gocheva. You're listening to The Review.
We turn to music now. Our guest today is Bill Brewster, known as being the DJ's DJs. He's an established music journalist and author of numerous books on dance music. The most famous of these is The Definitive History of the DJ and Their Role in Shaping Pop Culture. It's called Last Night a DJ Saved My Life. Welcome, Bill.
Hello there.
You've been attributed saying, I was reading, DJs, not musicians, are pop music's true revolutionaries at the moment. Do you think that's true of our times?
I think it can be, yes. It depends on the DJ, obviously, just as it depends on the musician with music. But yeah, I mean, there's certainly people who've pushed music forward in the past 30 to 40 years. Most of the new genres that exist and since the early 1970s have been driven by DJs or created by DJs.
What I find astonishing is you're talking about genres, and I think we've discussed this several times on The Review, that the current phase of music is revisiting a lot of stuff from the past, and a lot of the music that you've brought in is in from the past. How important a role is that of the DJ to bring old music and also pioneer music at the same time? Because we've got such a lovely back catalogue now that you can mix everything up.
It's quite a contradictory time, I think, and a lot of people, and what I'm surprised about is a lot of kids in their kind of late teens and early 20s are obsessed by music from, you know, the 80s or the 90s or the 70s in a way that perhaps my age group, my generation wasn't. You know, when I was a teenager and in my early 20s, I was kind of obsessed with the future. But it feels like we've arrived at the future and there is no more future in music. It's a strange time because I don't hear very much music now that doesn't in some way reference the past. And I don't know that that's a good thing. But I think that's generally a trend in culture across the board, not just in music.
Looking at the future, not the past. I mean, we've known, you know, Berlin, London, great places for dance music. What are the future places? Do you have a crystal ball that you can look at the future places?
That's really hard to say. I mean, I think the reason that Berlin has become such an important place is because it's a really cheap city to live in. And it was a cheap city to live in because of the post kind of communist era. Lots of people that I know have relocated there because you can be a creative person and not have to earn too much money to exist in Berlin. London and New York have become very difficult cities to live a creative life because they're so expensive to live in. So I think the future is in cities that are much more affordable.
What I find astonishing is that a neighbour of mine is a DJ and he always seems to be going to the Middle East. And that seems to be a very strange place to go and DJ.
Yes, it is. I've been once. It's quite strange.
Because who are the audiences there and what kind of night do you actually put on there?
Well, most of the audiences are expats. The nights tend to happen in hotel bars, so it's a slightly strange, false environment. Not one that I'm that keen on, really.
One place that we've been reading about recently is the way that America has been really buying into dance music in a big way. And we've got Swedish House Mafia and Calvin Harris playing enormous nights in the likes of Las Vegas. Is this a good thing, or are they just buying into something like you say, belongs in the past, and they're trying to turn it into a new thing?
Well, the actual scene, such as it is, I don't think bears any relationship to the club scene that produced dance music in the first place. That's not to say that I think it's a bad thing. I just don't think it's in any way similar to the black clubs and the gay clubs and the Latin clubs that produced disco, produced house, produced hip-hop in the past. And when I look at the crowds in those kind of events, they look like the sort of kids that would have been shaking their arms to Limp Bizkit 10 years ago. There doesn't really feel any kind of communion between the DJ and the music. It seems that a place to kind of wave your arms about in an indefinable way.
There's nothing wrong with that occasionally, Bill.
And they also seem to be very white in a country that is very culturally mixed. I find that really strange. However, I think if you're a 12-year-old kid, listening to that music is a lot more exciting than listening to hip-hop or country or rock music in the States. And I think in 5 or 6 years' time, when those kids start messing about on computers, they're probably produce some interesting music.
Now, you've brought in a collection of tunes that you want to play us, or you want us to play for you. Straddling genres, generations, it's a really eclectic mix. We're beginning with the Swedish electronic group Little Dragon.
I am.
Tell us why you chose to bring this in today. It's they're a staple of the Monocle 24 playlist. There will be no strangers to them. But what caught your eye?
Well, it's good to hear that you play them, because they're probably my favourite band. They've released 3 albums so far. They're from Gothenburg, and I've seen them live 2 or 3 times now. And what I love about them is their music on album is one thing, and it's great. But then you go and see them live, and they use the songs that they've released on their albums almost as a starting point for going in completely different directions with the music that they play live. They're a completely different entity when they play live, and I love the contrast between the two, because I find a lot of live music is very boring. It's just reproducing faithfully what somebody has done in the studio, and they don't do that. And that's one of the reasons I really love them.
Let's have a listen to their track, Ritual Union. From Sweden, that was Little Dragon and their track Ritual Union, the choice of Bill Brewster, known as the DJ's DJs, established music journalist, author of numerous books on dance music, and still DJing. And also, you used to be editor of Mix Mag, didn't you? Which was a staple on my coffee table a little while ago. How do you rate the state of dance music journalism now? I mean, where is it?
It's probably the same place it was 20 years ago. I mean, generally, I don't really think the standard of dance music is that good. And I think the problem with dance music, which is a long existing problem, is that lyrically it's not very interesting. And so it makes it harder to write about than with rock music. Most rock music journalists love deconstructing lyrics and finding out the meaning of Bob Dylan's lyrics and stuff like that. You don't have that with dance music, because really the effectiveness of dance music is about what it does to bodies on a dance floor, and that's a really hard thing to convey in print. So I think the standard generally has always been quite bad.
Where do you find good journalism, though? Because Mix Mag was the go-to magazine.
I think you find it in individuals, really, rather than magazines. There are some very good writers that write for Mix Mag, just as there are good writers writing for other magazines as well. Philip Sherburn, who's based in Berlin, an American writer who writes for Spin, I think he's really good. There's plenty of good writers out there.
How has the art of DJ changed with the advent of technology? And before, I would think you'd have to, you know, go miles and miles looking through old vinyl shops. How has it changed the finding of and the performing of being a DJ?
Well, there are different ways to find it, but I don't think fundamentally it's changed what a DJ does and what a DJ's job is. Essentially, your job is to filter out all the crap and play the good stuff. I mean, that's essentially what a DJ is. A DJ is a filter. So you're the one that will spend all week listening to 200 bad records in order to find the 5 good records and play them to your audience that weekend. So, and in that sense, I don't think the job has changed at all. It's just the methods that you use to find that music have changed slightly.
Well, Bill, we mentioned that you have brought a collection of tunes in today which are crossing borders and generations and genres. This latest track, from this next track, is from Alan Price, Sell, Sell. Quite an unusual choice, I'd have thought.
Well, I'm a big fan of charity shops, and I spend a lot of time in charity shops just looking for anything that looks vaguely interesting. You know, if there's a percussionist on an album that I know, I'd buy the album. If there's a track with a title like Africa in it, I would buy it because I think maybe there's something funky on there. And I bought this from a charity shop years ago. It's from a soundtrack album, Oh Lucky Man, which is quite a well-known British film. And Alan Price's stuff I always really liked when I was a kid. He had some sort of he had some hits in the early 70s. But this is just really funky and really well produced, and I love the song as well. There's a really great live version of it by Alan Price as well.
Let's have a listen.
Sell, 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 sell everything you stand for. Tell, 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 tell all the people that you care for. Running here, running there.
And that's Alan Price and Sell, Sell, the choice of Bill Brewster, the DJ's DJ, joining us on today's review. Bill, when we were listening to that, I said that's a really unusual choice of sound from a boy who grew up in Durham. Dance music originally was for the marginalised sections of society, but obviously the way that it's crossed over is exemplified in that track. Why did you choose that track in particular?
I'm always looking for interesting music in all kinds of different ways. I mean, you know, the reason I spend a lot of time in charity shops is you can buy lots of albums for very little money, and occasionally you just turn up really bizarre records that are playable in a nightclub, and that's kind of what I'm always looking for, is unusual music that will still work on a dance floor. And that's a really great example of something I spent 10p in a charity shop and found that.
What are you playing at the moment?
I play across the board, really. It really depends on who's employing me. you know, I did a gig a few weeks ago playing Blue Eyed Soul for 2 hours, and then the week after I did a gig where I was just playing house music all night. It really depends on what people want me to do.
So what makes a good venue? I mean, I know if we all knew that, you know, magic dust, everyone would be a success, but what is it that makes a good space?
Small. With only one entrance into it and exit out of it. If you have more than one, it creates a corridor and you just lose the kind of communal feeling. It has to be dark, moody, very little lighting, and a great crowd of people. I mean, the most important thing is...
Sounds like your parents' basement.
Exactly. The most important thing in a good club are the people.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think of the great big clubs and the huge venues in the likes of Ibiza?
It's not really... my kind of scene, you know. I mean, I go there and I've played at Space several times and they're really nice people, but it's not really for me.
I must ask you, though, you say that you play whatever people ask you to play to a certain degree. Have you ever been told, can you do this tonight, and you have no idea where to go with that set of music?
Yes.
What happened?
Well, you kind of improvise as best you can. I mean, sometimes you get employed to play somewhere, and in the old days it would be very difficult because you'd have a box of vinyl records of maybe 75 records, and you get there and you realise you've got maybe 2 records that are going to work. Mm. And you just have these kind of painful sort of gradual emptying of the dance floor as you try and measure between the next record that's going to work. That doesn't happen very much now because I take CDs with me and I've got maybe 1,500 songs with me, so I know I'm going to find something that's going
to
work.
Great art, having to read being able to read the room. Great,
I suppose so, but that's one of those things that you learn to do by making loads and loads of mistakes. You learn far more from having terrible nights than you do from good nights. You know, a good night is when everything you want to happen happens, and a bad night is the opposite. And those are the nights when you really learn about your job.
Do you still get bad nights? I hate to ask.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, absolutely. Not often. I mean, usually on a bad night, I can turn it around. But, you know, if there's nobody there, for example, there's not a great deal
you
can do.
Not much you can do. I didn't mean to ask that, but I didn't want to know. A very cheeky question. Your final choice is Destroyer, Song for America. A really unusual choice, because when I first heard it, I thought this is straight from the 1980s with a sort of warmth served with a maraschino cherry. But it's not. It's a completely modern piece of music, isn't it?
It is. They're a band that Ewan Pearson, a well-known DJ and producer who lives in Berlin now, introduced me to. He recommended their album Kaput, which is their last album. It's basically a one-man band, and he's done about 9 albums. This is the last album he did, which came out about a year and a half ago. And I love it. It actually reminds me of early albums by The Cure and very British early 80s sounding music, but he's from Vancouver. But it's a great album.
Bill, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We'll say thank you very much indeed, Bill Brewster, the DJ's DJ, music journalist, and of course author of numerous books. Your latest book has just come out, hasn't it? We'll have a listen to Destroyer, Song for America.
For America, they told me it was clever. I wrote a song for America, they told me.
And that was Song for America by Destroyer, the final choice of our guest, Bill Brewster, known as the DJ's DJ, also an established music journalist. And we neglected to say he has a new book out called The Record Players, which was published a couple of weeks ago.
Well, it's time now for our cultural city guide. Today we're off to Amsterdam, where Cynthia Taylor guides us through some of the highlights over the coming days.
It's film festival season in Amsterdam. This weekend, the Amsterdam Film Week wraps up its second edition. The event showcases some of the best award-winning films of the year, alongside previews for the most anticipated titles. Among those to watch out for this weekend are Trouble with the Curve with Clint Eastwood and The Company You Keep with Shia LaBeouf and Susan Sarandon, who's honored by the festival with a retrospective on her work. If you prefer non-fiction, then Wednesday sees the start of the International Documentary Film Festival Amsterdam, or ITFA. It's a special edition this year as organizers are celebrating the 25th anniversary of the event. The program contains over 200 documentary films, ranging from political matters to arts and culture. ITFA has become a landmark for the film industry over the years, providing masterclasses and Q&As with directors and producers. Her work has been labeled strange, shocking, and genial. It's the late photographer Diane Arbus, whose iconic pictures are on display at Amsterdam's photo museum, FOAM. This new exhibition is a retrospective of the artist's work, including some of her best-known photographs, alongside work which is being exhibited for the first time. FOAM is always a good choice for those wanting to escape the huge crowds queuing up for the city's major museums. If you're into jazz, then this Saturday you should head to Studio K in the east part of town to see both established and up-and-coming artists perform at Jazz Fest. The venue's 4 rooms will be hosting concerts until 1 a.m. After that, there are DJs to keep the party spirit going. And Dansgroep Amsterdam, the city's main modern dance company, are bringing their latest show, Domestica, to town this weekend. The group have been touring the country since September, but it's the first time they will be performing this new show to Amsterdammers. It's on today and tomorrow at the Compagnie Theater in the center of town, close to the Newmarkt area. For Monocle in Amsterdam, I'm Cynthia Taylor.
Stay with us, because in a moment we'll be visiting one of London's finest fashion and photography bookshops to get some recommendations.
From 8 a.m. London time and 9 a.m. Central European time every weekday, Monocle 24 presents The Continental Shift. Our editors guide you through 4 hours of hand-picked music, from Danish ballads to German electro-pop and beyond. Plus all the headlines from the European papers, regular check-ins with our correspondents and editors, and the news bulletin at the top of the hour. That's The Continental Shift, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. It's Saturday, so you must be listening to The Review. We end today's programme with one of our favourite pastimes, shopping for books.
Earlier this week, Monocle's researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco went to visit Claire de Rouen Books. This tiny bookseller is located in the heart of London's Soho. It sells specialist photography and fashion books. And as its owner explains, its story is rooted in the visual arts.
I'm Lucy Moore, and I'm the director of Claire de Rouen Books, and I have been directing the bookshop since April this year, after Claire passed away in early January. It opened almost 7 years to the day, actually, on the 2nd of November in 2005, and Claire launched Bruce Weber's new book, which was called Blood, Sweat and Tears, as part of the opening of the bookshop. So the bookshop's been open for about 7 years. But prior to that, Claire de Rouen worked at the Photographer's Gallery in the bookshop there, and then at Zwemme also, which is another bookshop further down on Charing Cross Road that closed down a few years ago. And actually that sort of prompted Claire to set up her own bookshop.
Tell us about the location. There's like a lovely little entrance. It's right here in Soho.
It's hard to find the bookshop. It's up a little white staircase. It's not very glamorous, but it's secret, and it's nice people that know the bookshop come up here. And really, once you're here, it's like being in a house, really, rather than a shop. And we make ourselves at home very much so. But also, yeah, in terms of, you know, Soho and being part of that community, Claire was very much part of it for a very long time. And it's one of the few remaining kind of bastions of old Soho, I think. And that's really nice to be part of that now for me, because Soho's always been very special to me. So yeah, it's lovely that I'm here.
Just a question, who are your customers?
They're very different. They're all very different. It's quite hard to categorise, actually. They're students, photo book enthusiasts, lots of photographers, some people who just find the bookshop and are really happy to find it. Others are confused, and when they find it, they're looking for, you know, books on physics, which we don't have. Then we also work with production companies, helping them with research for ad proposals or film production, and again with fashion houses for their research. So I do get together lists of books that I then give to, you know, McQueen or Celine or etc.
Fantastic. And now I think we're gonna do like a couple of titles that you chose that you sell here. And can you tell us a little bit more? Shall we start with the one with the lovely orange cover?
Yeah. So this is an amazing new book, very, very new, just published by Mac Books, who are a London-based publisher, actually just down the road on Denmark Street. It's by a Norwegian photographer called Torbjørn Rodland, and it's called Vanilla Partner. The title is sort of reflects what's inside the book. It doesn't make sense immediately, but it's intriguing, and you start to come up with meanings of your own, really. So they're hard to classify. They're quite bizarre, sometimes still lives, sometimes portraits. He talks about the way that, you know, looking at photography, you don't come to it raw, you come to it with your own history and memory and culture. And I think for me, the reason the images are really interesting is because I have a really strong immediate response to them, but I'm not sure why. And I think that does connect to our cultural background and our memories and our history. And so it's a very interesting book in a way.
Shall we go to the next one?
Yeah. So this is similarly quite a mysterious book of photographs of clouds. And I guess I'm interested in the way photography started out claiming to be able to represent the truth in a way that the other arts couldn't. But these books both kind of use photography to think about mystery or what's mysterious. And so this is a collection of images taken from cloud atlases. So it's basically just images of clouds that are collected right from the mid-19th century up to today. And, you know, clouds are obviously this impossible to define kind of thing, but there have been historically attempts to classify them and categorize them. And
so many different shapes as well.
Yeah, and they're very much to do with our imagination. So they, you know, we always come, you know, you look at this sky and you imagine what they are, like that's a dog or that's a a sleigh. Anyway, I think this is quite a romantic book, and it's German. It's published by a German publisher called Spectre, and it's very beautiful. It's called Cloud Studies.
Very interesting. And I believe the last one is actually a photographer that I'm a big fan, Jürgen Teller, right?
Yeah.
Is it his new book? What is this book about?
No, this is a older book of Jürgen's called Go Sees, and it's quite rare now. It's a collection of pictures that Jürgen takes when models turn up to his door to take. They're kind of shots, like they're not for a particular job. They're just shots where the models introduce themselves to him. It's amazing because you get to see a whole kind of cross-section of 90s fashion, which is awful, in my opinion. But really interesting, you know, like just the relationship that he has with the models and the way they are in front of his camera at quite a kind of unstable point in their careers, because it's mainly just really young models. And then, you know, some of them, you know, there's Eva Herzegova and there's Jade Parfit's in it and Erin O'Connor, and you know you see them as really young girls, kind of just before they were super famous, and it's just great. You can just look at it forever. And this is, we're lucky to have this copy because it's quite hard to get hold of nowadays. So yeah,
I've noticed that you have quite a lot of exclusive products somehow, right? That you somehow you can only find here, or I mean very hard to find products.
Yeah, I think it's kind of important to offer something special here that you can't necessarily get in you know, Waterstones or on Amazon. And yeah, so we have lots of rare books and books that have been signed by the photographers. So often we do book launches and signings. We did one recently with Tim Walker that was really fun. He signed copies of his new book, Storyteller. And I just really want this space to be somewhere where, you know, you don't have to buy, like you can just look at, if it's like a super expensive rare book, it's just there that can be looked at, and people spend lots of time in here, you know, an hour, 2 hours, and talking as well, you know, which I really like doing, so.
And that was Lucy Moore from Claire de Rouen Books in London, Soho.
And that brings us to the end of our Saturday review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilbao, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Sam Impey.
We'll hand back to Georgina with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on the creator. Don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time. But you've been listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson, and Gillian DeBias. Goodbye. Have a great weekend.